The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Today I'll be reading from the Spring 2023 edition, Volume 62, Number 2. Its title is Legacies of Reconstruction, North Carolina After Emancipation. And the first article will be the Second Founding, North Carolina and the Reconstruction Amendments, by Ayla Amon, who is the former curator of political and cultural history at the North Carolina Museum of History. She is now curator of collections at the Greensboro History Museum. Quote from Frederick Douglass in a speech at the Republican National Convention in 1876. The question now is, do you mean to make good to us the promises in your Constitution? The American Civil War lasted only 4 years, from 1861 to 1865, but it left the political system in North Carolina in shambles. The era of Reconstruction attempted to fix it. In North Carolina, both state and local governments had collapsed. North Carolina came under the military rule of General John M. Schofield, while President Johnson, who was originally from Raleigh, decided how to remake the Union. Johnson issued two proclamations on May 29, 1865. The first, the Proclamation of Amnesty and Pardon, extended amnesty, forgiveness, to most Confederates who swore an oath of loyalty to the United States and the U.S. Constitution. The second proclamation appointed William W. Holden as the provisional or temporary governor of North Carolina. Johnson ordered Holden to call a state convention to restore North Carolina to the Union. The convention had to repeal the May 20, 1861 Ordinance of Secession. It had to ratify the 13th Amendment and cancel or refuse to pay on the Confederate war debt. The convention would also provide for the election of a new governor, state legislators, and U.S. congressmen to reestablish civil government in the state. This convention began on October 2, 1865. Despite heated debate, the convention members voted unanimously to accept the 13th Amendment on October 7th. They declared the Ordinance of Secession null and void on October 9th. And after Holden stepped in, they canceled the war debt on October 19th, the last day of the convention. However, they also resolved to seek the removal of all United States colored troops from the state. Congress ultimately refused to readmit North Carolina that December. Shortly after, what was known as presidential reconstruction was ended. Congress took over in 1867, additionally requiring former Confederate states to adopt new constitutions that included black suffrage, the right to vote, and to ratify the 14th Amendment. The convention of 1868 created a North Carolina state constitution that was ratified by a vote of 93,086 to 74,016. North Carolinians regained their seats in Congress, and the state was readmitted to the Union on July 4, 1868. But the work had just begun. While Reconstruction held many promises, it was filled with tension between the North and the South, between Democrats and Republicans, between people of color and white people, and between men and women. They were all fighting for a stake in the government and pushing to include or exclude people from civil rights. Explore the stories of three people who fought for equality, political, civil, and social, using the three Reconstruction Amendments. Their stories connect to larger narratives surrounding the challenges faced by freedmen, indigenous people, and women during this tumultuous time. Reconstruction Amendments, also called the Civil War Amendments, are the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the United States Constitution. They were ratified or approved between 1865 and 1870. Each of these amendments was meant to grant a certain civil, social, and political freedoms to formerly enslaved people, as well as protect other American citizens from discrimination. So the next article, the 13th Amendment, defining freedom. Section 1 of the 13th Amendment, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. The 13th Amendment in 1865 officially abolished or ended the system of slavery in the United States, unless as a punishment for a crime. It also stated that Congress had the power to enforce this prohibition. It made legal and permanent what Abraham Lincoln had promised in the 1863 Emancipation Proclamation. But it left some big questions for newly freed people in North Carolina. What rights would African Americans get as free people, and how would Congress enforce them? Even before the official ratification of the 13th Amendment on December 6, 1865, Black people had determined that they would decide what this freedom meant for themselves. Abraham Galloway, born 1837, died 1870, who was born enslaved in Smithville, now Southport, participated in these early efforts. Galloway had self-liberated on a trade ship carrying naval stores alongside fellow freedom seeker Richard Eden in 1857. But he did not stay away from the fight for emancipation long. In 1861, Galloway returned to the South working as a spy for the Union Army. He scouted Roanoke Island and assisted General Ambrose Burnside's troops in landing there. The Union won the resulting battle, securing a coastal outpost and tightening their blockade. Galloway was also a driving force in shaping state and local politics and pursuing political emancipation for African Americans in North America, even though they could not read or write. In May 1864, he was part of a delegation of five Black leaders who met with Abraham Lincoln and urged him to advocate for suffrage or voting rights for African Americans. And he was one of 144 Black leaders who attended the 1864 National Convention of Colored Men, one of the most important gatherings of African American leaders during the Civil War. He served as a vice president of the convention under Frederick Douglass's presidency. Galloway also organized North Carolina chapters of the National Equal Rights League, and on September 29, 1865, he helped lead the Convention of the Freedmen of North Carolina, pushing for equal rights before the law. This convention and the Freedmen's Convention in 1866 were the first of their kind in North Carolina, with delegates pushing for Black men to be included in all political and judicial processes. They were especially important in making sure Black votes were heard, since no Black men had been elected to the North Carolina Constitutional Convention of 1865. Despite the efforts of Galloway and others, the process was difficult, because Black men had not been given full political rights or even citizenship. Black codes, passed in 1866, resurrected the previous slave codes in North Carolina that restricted all aspects of Black people's lives, from voting to owning property, to education, to religious services, to traveling without permission, to legally marrying. These Black codes were passed by former Confederate states as a way of maintaining white supremacy and attempting to maintain slavery. African Americans were not allowed to vote, serve on juries, or testify against whites in court. They were given harsher punishments for crimes. Their ability to enter and leave the state was restricted, and they were often forcibly apprenticed to their former enslavers. They were also not allowed to run for political office, but they persisted in pursuing political and civil rights and overturning the Black codes. Galloway was one of 13 Black Republicans representing 19 majority Black counties at the Constitutional Convention of 1868, which laid out the new North Carolina Constitution. The new Constitution had to incorporate updated federal laws, including the 13th Amendment, in order for North Carolina to be officially readmitted to the Union. It also provided for universal mail voting rights, eliminated property and religious qualifications for voting and office holding, authorized the establishment of a general and uniform system of public schools, and mandated that county and executive officers were to be elected by the people. For the time, it was a modern, progressive, liberal, and democratic document that deviated from North Carolina's previously conservative political tradition. Black men won the right to vote the same year, and more than 70,000 voted in 1868 for the first time. It had been a long 3 years from the end of the Civil War to get to that point, but black men had finally gained the right to vote and run for political office. This led to a surge of black representation in state and local government, especially in eastern North Carolina. Galloway ran for the North Carolina Senate as a Republican in 1868. He was one of three black senators and 18 black representatives in the North Carolina General Assembly for 1868 to 1869, all of whom were able to vote for the 14th and 15th Amendments. Galloway died unexpectedly in 1870, having just been reelected to the North Carolina Senate. But he is remembered as one of 115 black Republican state legislators and 27 black United States congressmen who served North Carolina between 1868 and 1901. These men forced the nation to realize that emancipation from slavery was not enough, that real freedom lay in being able to make political, social, and civil decisions for oneself and one's family. However, anti-black sentiment in the country was strong. By the Compromise of 1877 and the withdrawal of federal troops from the South, conservative Democrats had reestablished most of their economic and social force. Before long, they regained political dominance as well, including at the violent election in Wilmington in 1898. Civil rights for African Americans also eroded as Congress, the U.S. Supreme Court, and Northerners lost interest in the issue. The slave codes that had become the Black Codes were resurrected in Jim Crow laws and other forms of discrimination until they were successfully challenged in the civil rights era of the 1950s and 1960s. Here are the captions of the photographs accompanying this article. This portrait of Abraham Galloway was made shortly after he arrived in Philadelphia, having self-liberated from North Carolina on the Maritime Underground Railroad in 1857. This button from the 1963 March on Washington reflects how Martin Luther King Jr. carried on the legacy of the early black politicians. He practiced his speech in Rocky Mount on November 27, 1962, saying, "I have a dream that one day, right here in Rocky Mount, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will meet at the table of brotherhood." And the 13th Amendment was passed by Congress on January 31, 1865, and ratified on December 6, 1865. It abolished slavery in the United States. Next, the 14th Amendment, pushing for citizenship. Here's section 1 of the 14th Amendment. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. The 14th Amendment of 1868 addresses citizenship, as well as providing equal protection under the law regardless of race. The amendment was strongly contested, particularly by the former Confederate states, which were forced to ratify it to regain representation in Congress and be admitted to the Union. While it was proposed in response to issues surrounding newly freed people, it had much broader implications for other non-white people in the United States. Would indigenous people who maintain tribal allegiances be considered citizens and given access to those same legal protections? Though they had long histories on the land that became North Carolina, American Indians had to fight both for their personal as well as tribal rights throughout Reconstruction. Henry Barry Lowry, born around 1845, and died sometime after 1872, was born into a tumultuous moment in American history. A member of what became known as the Lumbee Tribe, he lived with his parents and 13 brothers and sisters on a large farm in the Hopewell community in Robeson County. The family had been part of the community for more than a century, but significant political and legal shifts in the mid-1800s saw prosperity and rights change significantly for indigenous families. Lowry decided to fight back against these policies. Alfred Townsend, a correspondent for the New York Herald in the late 1800s, described Lowry as one of those remarkable executive spirits that arises now and then in a raw community without advantages other than those given by nature. Lowry took his remarkable spirit and fought for the well-being and civil rights of minorities beginning during the Civil War. Before the Civil War, federal policies surrounding indigenous groups in North Carolina were based on desires for land. These desires, expressed through one-sided treaties, wars, enslavement, and relocations, over time decreased the indigenous population in the state and destroyed their trust in the American government. In 1830, President Andrew Jackson signed the Indian Removal Act. This authorized the president to negotiate with southern indigenous tribes over their removal to federal territory west of the Mississippi River, in exchange for giving up their ancestral lands. This act and prior treaties led to the forced removal of more than 17,000 Cherokee from North Carolina to present-day Oklahoma on the Trail of Tears in the late 1830s. A few remained behind, eventually becoming the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. As racial attitudes hardened, members of indigenous groups who remained in North Carolina also found themselves faced with the loss of political and civil rights. In 1835, the North Carolina Constitution stripped the rights of indigenous and other non-white men of their right to vote. It also removed their right to serve in the militia, or to own or carry firearms or other weapons without a license. During the Civil War, indigenous people fought strategically for their own rights and to pursue tribal rights. Many of the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Indians in western North Carolina supported the Confederacy. Thomas's Legion, a well-known fighting unit, had two companies of Cherokee soldiers. This proved politically dangerous, as Congress passed a law in 1862 that allowed the president to cancel treaties with Indian nations siding with the Confederacy. In eastern North Carolina, the Lumbee were conscripted or forced to work building Confederate fortifications near Wilmington. Rather than be forced to labor, many Lumbee fled and formed bands of resistance. Henry Barry Lowry was part of one such group, waging guerrilla warfare against the Confederate Home Guard. This engagement helped spark Lowry's desire for justice, and he continued resisting white supremacy after the war's end. Reconstruction and the push for new civil rights for non-white people initially offered some hope of improved circumstances for indigenous people in North Carolina, who had retained a hard-won degree of cultural and sometimes political independence. This promise quickly disappeared. Invigorated by the end of the war, the United States government consolidated its social and political power and developed a new Indian policy that forever altered the lives of indigenous people and the contours of the American West. Policymakers had to determine how to relocate indigenous people, how reservations would be managed, and how to force cultural assimilation, how to make indigenous people more American. These policies did not just take place in the West, however, but also affected the indigenous people of North Carolina. To further their land claims in the West during Reconstruction, the U.S. government withheld citizenship and the civil and judicial rights that came with it from indigenous people. Instead, they interpreted the citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment, which provided everyone born in the United States with American citizenship, in a way that excluded most indigenous peoples. Not only did this help the U.S. government seize more and more indigenous territory in the West, but it also prevented indigenous people from assembling any political power. In a sense, surviving tribes were made foreigners on their own land. Henry Barry Lowry continued to fight this inequality, protected by a wide support network made up of indigenous people, freedmen, and poor whites. He disappeared in 1872, but his legacy lived on in the indigenous people and their supporters, who continued to fight for equality and who maintained their cultural traditions. It was not until the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924 that indigenous peoples were officially made citizens of the land where they had lived for centuries. And it was not until the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that they were given the right to vote in all states. But the fight for civil rights and tribal recognition persists today. Here are the captions to the accompanying photographs. Chief Howard Brooks led a group of Tuscarora to the state capitol in Raleigh in a march against lack of political control over their own community, as well as not having federal tribal recognition in 1973. And President Andrew Johnson signed this warrant on July 11, 1868, acknowledging that North Carolina had ratified the 14th Amendment. We will cover the 15th Amendment in the next episode. For now, here's a sidebar article, Another Kind of Slavery, by Roanne Bishop. In 1875, state legislators authorized the use of convict labor on the Western North Carolina Railroad to cut costs and speed work on the project. The rail line was planned to connect with the North Carolina Railroad in Salisbury and run westward to the Tennessee border, opening the mountain region to trade and tourism. But the American Civil War, political corruption, and fraud delayed the line's construction. By 1869, it had reached only as far as Old Fort in McDowell County. To get the railroad up Old Fort Mountain and across the Eastern Continental Divide required the construction of 6 tunnels, 9 miles of looping track, and eventually the back-breaking labor of around 3,000 incarcerated workers. The first boxcar of prisoners from the state penitentiary in Raleigh arrived in Henry Station just west of Old Fort in October of 1875. Most of these laborers were African Americans. Many were formerly enslaved people. Some had been charged falsely or imprisoned for petty crimes. But all of them, men and women, were forced to work unpaid on the railroad. The workers toiled from sunrise to sunset. Women prisoners cooked, cleaned, and did laundry in the 5 stockades that housed the laborers. The men cleared forests, leveled the land, laid tracks, built trestles, and dug and blasted tunnels through solid granite. Much of the work was done by hand, using picks, shovels, and flat rocks. At least 139, perhaps as many as 400, of the workers died while building the Western North Carolina Railroad. Blasting accidents, landslides, and cave-ins killed many. Others perished from malnutrition and disease. Several were shot trying to escape. All lied buried in unmarked graves alongside the tracks still used by trains today. In 2020, some Western North Carolina historians and community leaders established the Railroad and Incarcerated Laborers Memorial Committee to raise funds for a memorial to those rail workers whose lives, adversities, and accomplishment have been all but forgotten. The River Rock Monument, on which many of the workers' names are now etched, stands near the tracks at Andrews Geyser in Old Fort. It was dedicated on October 17, 2021. Here are the captions accompanying the photographs. Some incarcerated railroad laborers momentarily cease work on the North Carolina Railroad's Mountain Division near Old Fort to pose for this late 1870s photograph. And stonemason Paul Twitty and his assistant Jimmy Logan put finishing touches on a new memorial in Old Fort that honors the railroad workers. Accompanying this article is a Think About It. One of the best things about life in our country and our state is that history keeps happening. Many people continue to work to make things better and better, and each generation is part of that continuing story. That means you. Think about these questions. What do you think would make our country better? What kinds of laws or amendments would you propose to make that vision a reality? Now, from the back cover, what's that? Are you curious? Historians need to be. They must often study old, mysterious objects or artifacts to figure out what they were used for. Guessing is a good way to start. This artifact is more than 100 years old. Can you guess what it is? Is it a cage that was used to take a small pet on a train ride? A simple, old-timey washing machine? You put your clothes inside the box and then dunked it up and down in a barrel of hot, soapy water? A box used for voting that allowed everyone to see your ballot and tell who you voted for? Or a pie safe? It was used for cooling cakes and pies while protecting them from sneaky kids trying to eat dessert before dinner. Well, the answer is on page 21, which is in the Stories from Our Collection section, and it's a ballot box, circa mid-1800s to mid-1900s. Today, when Americans vote in an election, our votes are supposed to be private. But during the mid-1800s to early 1900s, North Carolina political parties printed their own ballots, often on colored paper. Local county election boards provided the ballot boxes, and some used see-through ballot boxes like this one. So when a person put their ballot in this box, anybody could see the color of their ballot and easily tell which party they were voting for. Voters might experience pressure, bribery, or even threats to vote a certain way. Secret ballots were not required by state law until 1929. Here's another story from our collection, a tintype circa 1880s to 1890s. A tintype or ferrotype is a photograph made by creating a positive image on a thin, darkened sheet of metal. Tintypes became popular during the 1860s and 70s because they were cheap and easy to make. They were also lightweight, which made them easy to carry in a pocket as a keepsake. At first, these photos were created in a formal studio, but later, traveling photographers would set up at fairs and carnivals, so more people had the opportunity to have a photo made. This tintype is believed to be of Parker David Robbins. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.
She was born on a farm, working the clay. She ran off when she was 16. Down a long country road with nowhere to go, she knew that she had to leave. She hopped a one-way train with a ticket to ride in the third class.